Aspects of Love, with music by Berlioz, Strauss, piano music by Suk, and other pieces by Puccini and Dvorak. That's 9 o'clock next Sunday morning. Sunday Morning is a unique production for BBC Radio 3, with studio production this morning by Neil Miners. Well, you're listening to BBC Radio 3. It's 12 o'clock and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
The choreographer Arlene Phillips came to prominence when she created the hugely popular dance group Hot Gossip. Having trained in dance from an early age, she had a particular love of modern American jazz. Since those early days, Arlene has choreographed for a huge variety of shows, commercials, music videos, plays. She's currently working on The Wizard of Oz. And, of course, she was a much-loved judge on Strictly Come Dancing. How did dance come to your bones so naturally and from such a young age, Arlene?
Dance first came into my bones when I was 2.5 years old and I wanted to go to ballet class. And I went to my ballet class, paid for by my uncle. The teacher asked us all to do step together, step hop. And when I couldn't do it, shouted at me, and I vowed I would never go back. But my family, my parents were passionate about the ballet, passionate about dance, and we played records all the time. And we would go and see dance. My father would take us, even though we were standing in the gods at the Manchester Palace, the Manchester Opera House, to see dance. And by the age of 8, I wanted to go to ballet class, and I knew that was what I wanted to do in my life, and nothing has ever stopped me.
I get the impression, reading about your life, that there's a degree of serendipity involved. You happen to be at the right time, at the right place, and a certain film director, I think, asked you to do something that led to something else. That's right, isn't it?
Absolutely. My life has always turned on a dime, as they might say, because the coincidences that have happened, that have changed my life, have been extraordinary. And yes, Ridley Scott certainly changed my life. I was a dance teacher because my mother sadly passed away when I was 15 years old. And although I was studying dance, there was a commitment with my brother and my sister that we would stay in Manchester. We would stick together after losing my mother, even though my dreams were to go to London, to go to a dance school in London, to study in London. I knew I couldn't, so I remained in Manchester. And then I continued my dance and studies and then started to teach. My ballet teacher at the school said, I want you to go to London. There's a place opened on Floral Street, Covent Garden, called the Dance Centre. Go there and learn some new things to bring back to Manchester. Well, I did learn something new. I learnt modern American jazz, which I've never done before. And I call my family and I call my teacher and I said, I'm never coming home again. I found something I want to do and I will pay you back every penny. And I stayed in London and worked in the worst situations. But some of them were quite nice, and one was babysitting for Ridley Scott. And I looked after his oldest son. And one day he said, all this dance you do, I've got a commercial that I need choreographing. It's for Lion's Maid Ice Cream, and it's only a milkmaid and a dancing cow. Can you do it? And I said, well, I'll give it a try.
A dancing cow.
And a dancing cow. Two people in the cow. And that was my first job, and it worked. And then he asked me if I would do another commercial. And he said, it's for an American product called Dr. Pepper. They're coming over from America. So the American producer said, no, 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 we don't want an English choreographer. We want to bring someone from America. And Ridley didn't want to work with an American choreographer. He said, no, no, I've got this fabulous girl. And he said, call her, talk to her. Well, unfortunately, the only time she could talk to me was when I was teaching class, 4:30, the Dance Centre on Floral Street, but there was a phone in the room. And just before class, I put the music on, told everybody to stretch out, do the port de bras to one of my favourite pieces of music, Pachelbel. And there, I couldn't believe it, there was the phone call, the voice, Linda Meverack. Hi, Meverack here. I believe Ridley wants to use you for a commercial. I mean, we have choreographers. And I said, I know, I've worked with Ridley and he's asked that we should talk. She said, what's that music? I know that music. And I told her and she said, ha, my favourite piece too. You got the job, honey. I'll see you. And that was it. That's exactly how it happened. And of course, my life then exploded as a choreographer. The Dr. Pepper commercials were huge. 42 dances in one commercial, the whole of Royal Ballet in another of the commercials. And that was it.
And I suppose your exposure to modern American jazz meant that you gave your work, especially in that direction, the commercial direction, a bit of a kick, if you like, compared to the ordinary run-of-the-mill.
I think definitely. For me, I saw a change of path. I knew that modern American jazz could be used, but not as pure jazz, but on what was going on in the streets today. London was buzzing in the streets. The King's Road, Kensington Market. There was something going on. There was a zeitgeist. People were
changing. That smell of patchouli oil.
Of course, the smell of patchouli oil and the fashions that people were wearing. But there was no way that this looked like anything I'd ever seen on television. I would turn my TV on and saw a lot of dancers, step kick and doing lots of smiles. But I wanted to put together these worlds that I had fallen into, the world of the street, the world of jazz, the world of ballet, and mix them all up.
Well, curiously, everything you've just described could be applied in another way, in another world, in another idiom, to the first music you've chosen. In other words, Bernstein, West Side Story.
Absolutely. I first saw this as a 15-year-old girl in Manchester. I was studying classical dance. I was at school. My mother was very, very, very ill. And I was low. I was mixed up. And then West Side Story first came and had its European premiere at the Opera House in Manchester in 1958. And I was standing at the back with the crowds of my dance friends watching this unfold before my eyes. I had never seen anything like it. It felt all my dreams, my birthdays, my Christmases were here on this one night. And there was a burning inside me to go to London. I knew I never could. But that was my dream and that lived and spoke to me. And when I saw the dance at the gym, the dancers with, I guess, an air of Gene Kelly, but even rougher, real, and containing Latin, containing jazz.
Quite macho.
Oh, yes, and strong and powerful with an aggression. And it exploded in front of my eyes. And I couldn't sleep that night because I wanted to hold everything inside me, inside my memory.
We'll be right back. I've always thought that the arrival of West Side Story on the history of the musical is sort of almost as enormous as the Rite of Spring in classical music, because it brought a completely different approach, didn't it? Something that was zappy, streetwise, and where the music did, as you say, have this element of jazz to it.
Yes, and Latin influences, and of course the incredible choreography by Jerome Robbins, who in many ways was, I think, a method choreographer, because he kept the Jets and the Sharks apart when he created this, and he set them up being kinder to one group more than the other and setting up the friction. So it really was a very sort of method form of choreography, but also his choreography from the brilliant classical ballets he's created to this street language where he can make a walk say more than most people can make a whole dance say is something, I think, that every choreographer and dancer, well, he is held high in their esteem.
That's the original soundtrack recording we heard there, conducted by Johnny Green, of Dance at the Gym from Bernstein's West Side Story. Now, you were talking about going in Manchester to see the ballet, and I think the first music from that experience that you've chosen is Tchaikovsky.
Yes. Is there a ballet more attractive to a young girl than The Sleeping Beauty? I can't imagine, because from the moment that it begins, as a small child, you've heard the story countless times, and then to listen to Tchaikovsky and realise that someone put together this piece from his music and so clearly and beautifully told the story. And I find there are many pieces of music that can make me cry. Instantly I hear them, there's a trigger that makes me sob, and I have no understanding why, but I know that at that time I also need to cry. And I find the panorama in Sleeping Beauty, it feels that it's wrapping me in a cloak and allowing me to sob. Very often there's very little dance in that moment. You're seeing the forest changing, and Sleeping Beauty is sleeping for 100 years, but it sends chills through me.
Thank you.
and he wakens her with a kiss and they live happily ever after, which is my dream.
But you know, you were saying how that music has a kind of emotional pull on you. And I'll never forget when they had to close down the Royal Opera House to be refurbished.
Yes.
At the end of the evening, Darcy Bustle danced that transformation scene. And it was absolutely... because, you know, she was putting the house to sleep.
Yes.
Music from The Sleeping Beauty, Act 2, Scene 1 by Tchaikovsky. The National Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Richard Bonning. The wonderful thing, Arlene Phillips, about the job you've done is that it takes you down so many different avenues of musical creation, doesn't it?
Yes.
And the next one is Andrew Lloyd Webber, who you've worked with a lot, I think.
Yes. Andrew Lloyd Webber and my association with him is very strange. I was in ballet school with a wonderful student called Kathy Lawrence, and we were best friends right through ballet school, who eventually went to London, met Rod Argent and married Rod Argent.
Great keyboard player.
Oh, brilliant.
Had a keyboard shop, in fact, in the West End.
He did Rod indeed.
Argent keyboards.
Yes.
Yeah.
On Denmark Street, wasn't it?
Hmm.
Yes. And Kathy and I, of course, remained in touch. And one day, Rod and Kathy invited me to go to Andrew Lloyd Webber's house in Sidmonton. And I got to know Andrew, and it was just wonderful. It was really a remarkable sort of coming together. And then Rod and Kathy brought Andrew to see Hot Gossip, and we became very close and very good friends. And Andrew remembered the little story I told him when I was pregnant in 1979 and roller skating in LA. And I told him this at the end of 79. And in 1982, he called me up and said, "Do you remember that story you told me about roller skating? Do you still roller skate?" I said, "Well, in fact, I do. I kept it up." And he said, "Right, I've got a musical I want you to choreograph. It's on roller skates." And that was Starlight Express. And if I hadn't been in his home in 79, this would never have happened. But one of my favourite pieces of music is the Paganini Variations. And I asked Andrew why he had done this piece of music and why he had worked on it. And he said, "Well, many composers have worked on this piece of music. And I wanted to do something for a rock band and a cello. And of course, my brother plays the cello. And that's why I did it. And I love it. Every time I hear it, I want to get up and dance."
It's a great tune.
It's a great tune, and I think what he's done with it is brilliant, and it makes my feet move.
It was a very clever idea to use that, actually, for that tune, because it's, it takes any kind of treatment, well, like a good tune does.
Yes.
And we heard a whole load of musicians from that period who were absolutely the top of their game at the time, quite apart from Julian Lobo playing the cello, obviously, mm-hmm. but Dawn Airey, Rod Argent playing keyboards, John Heisman, drums and percussion, lovely fat bass with John Mole, Gary Moore playing guitar, and Barbara Thompson playing wind instruments.
Absolutely brilliant, brilliant artists, all of them.
The theme from Andrew Lloyd Webber's Variations, based on the Paganini Caprice in A minor, number 24. Well, we might as well get these two big musical areas out of the way straight away, Arlene Phillips, because we're coming on to Les Misérables next.
Yes. Well, who doesn't love Les Misérables, and who doesn't spend a night of great emotion in the theatre watching it? But I had a very strange thing happen, because I was on Twitter. I joined, I guess, reasonably late. And one day somebody tweeted me and went, "You must listen to Alfie Beau singing Bring Him Home on Twitter." And I thought, OK, I'll listen to it. Then somebody else responded. And suddenly I thought, my goodness, I better listen to this quickly so I can answer all these people who are telling me to listen to Alfie Beau. I listened. His voice went straight into my heart like an arrow shooting out of the recording.
God on high, hear my prayer, in my need, you have always been there, he is yours. Let him rest, heaven bless, bring him home, bring him home, bring him home.
He's like the sun I might have known, if God had granted me a son. The summers die one by one, how soon they fly, on, and I am old and will be gone. Bring him. Die, let me die.
Alfie Beau was singing Bring Him Home from Les Miserables by Schoenberg and Boublier. Now, Arlene Phillips, interesting, we couldn't be turning a more acute corner here, mm-hmm. because from the musical, the commercial world, we're turning, thanks to a great scholar, actually, who was a friend of yours, I think. And I don't know what he would make of Les Miserables, but I certainly know that he was pretty keen on the next music.
Yes. I first met Stanley Sadie when my daughter, who just turned 33, went to her first day at a school called St. Christopher's. And as we walked out of our house, mother and daughter, to take the little girl to her first day at school, out of the house opposite walked a man and his little daughter, and we walked the same path. And of course, we met at the school and we started talking. And that was Stanley Sadie and his wonderful daughter, Celia. And only as the term went on did I really get to know him. And suddenly, he was a man with a knowledge of Mozart that was endless. And not only Mozart, but of course I discovered he was working on the Grove Dictionary of Music.
Yes, and he edited the Musical Times for a while.
Absolutely, and a man of such musical knowledge that I would just sit in his house just listening to him talk. And he talked to me about Mozart the man, that he knew so much about the history of the music and how it all happened. And of course, I then started listening to Mozart. I'd listened to it before, but only when it was music that I wanted to use to dance to or to move to. And then he played me the Requiem in D minor, and I felt it in my skin. I felt the emotion so, so deeply, and have listened to it ever since.
Thank you.
something extraordinarily portentous about that music, isn't there?
Yes. And the pain. The pain is searing through it, and you can't help feeling the agony of the man.
Very beautiful, the word, isn't it? Lacrimosa.
Yes.
Lacrimosa, tears.
Yes, tears.
Yes. The Lacrimosa from the Requiem in D minor, Kirkel 626 by Mozart. And we heard the John Aldiss Choir and the English Chamber Orchestra conducted by Daniel Barenboim. Now, I think, Arlene Phillips, that we have a mutual friend who we've both collaborated with, who's a small but larger than life bundle of mischief. Do you know who I'm referring to?
Couldn't be Wayne Sleep, could it? Bundle of mischief and naughtiness. Mm. Yes, indeed.
With a great twinkle in the eye.
Well, Wayne Sleep, when he was in the Royal Ballet, used to creep down Floral Street to my jazz classes. Now, at that time, jazz classes were forbidden to Royal Ballet dancers. They had to do classical only, but not good enough for Wayne. And he used to just pretend that he was going off to classical class, and he would come into my class. And we became great, great friends and spent lots and lots of time together. And he used to sneak me backstage to the opera house to watch him dance on stage. And one of my favourite ballets was La Female Gardée. And Wayne would say, come on, come on down. And I would be standing watching this amazing moment when there was a clog dance, and I'm a Lancashire lass, and so clogging was popular. And to use clogging in a ballet was wonderful, never been seen before, although the ballet actually was first created in, I think, 1789, when you think how old that is, and that it has consistently changed since then to create what it has become. But La Female Gardée, one of my favourite ballets.
I think the Royal Ballet have been very fortunate in having various people over the years who defined their era, in a sense, musically. It was Constant Lambert, of course, early on. But then John Lanchbury, who helped create Tales of Beatrix Potter and things like that.
Yes.
And he indeed made that arrangement of Herold's music, the clog dance from La Female Gardée, with the orchestra of the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden, conducted by John Lanchbury. Arlene Phillips, you were talking earlier about Jerome Robbins and New York. And of course, I think it was there later that you also encountered Twyla Tharp.
Yes. I was choreographing commercials both in England and in New York, because the Dr. Pepper commercials I was talking about earlier had been such a success. And that's where I first discovered Twyla Tharp. And I was an immediate devotee and went to see every piece that she did. And eventually I went to see a piece that she had created with music by a musician that I love, Philip Glass. And it was a piece called In the Upper Room, where the music is repetitive without doubt, but it winds and twists and repeats and builds and builds and builds. And it has the beat of your heart. So there is a moment where you can no longer contain yourself and you're just standing up and cheering. You are guaranteed almost to form a standing ovation, because music and dance that move on and on and on ever forward lift you up and out of your seat. And In the Upper Room by Twyla Tharp certainly did that to me. I wish that the listeners could see the dancers bursting on the stage, continuing in this repetition and fusion of classical dancers on pointe shoes and dancers in trainers. We had never seen anything like that before. We never mixed classical with jazz and pop dance, and never stopping, and each lift getting higher and higher. And I just ask the listeners to close their eyes and just imagine dancers bursting in front of them.
Dance 9 from In the Upper Room by Philip Glass, conducted by Michael Riesman. Well, at last, Arlene, we can hear your Canon by Pachelbel, which was so important to you early on and which helped you become a choreographer. When you hear it again, what do you love about the music? It seems to me that this has a kind of graceful inevitability about it.
It does. The music is beautiful for what we call in dance port de bras, which is a movement of the arms, because as you lift and raise your arms, you lift and feel the air. And as you bring your arms down, you feel the air going through the hands and the fingers. And this music, again, has a sort of mantra-like feel, a great peacefulness about it, and very, very, very good to warm up the body to, which you have to do in peace. You can't fight it to get your body to do what you want.
So it's the converse, in a sense, of the glass, where busyness and energy were. This is all about the reverse, calmness and beauty of line.
Yes, it's almost like a meditation.
The Canon in D Major by Pachelbel, played by the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Leonard Slatkin. Now, I think your first show, Arlene, was a great celebration of tango.
The first show that I produced was a great celebration of tango, Argentine tango especially. And, of course, I had always gone to see tango companies. I had studied ballroom and Latin, and then I became involved with Strictly Come Dancing and fell in love with Vincent and Flavia. And when they had decided that they were going to do their own show, the producer of the show, Adam Spiegel, who I had worked with on Saturday Night Fever, he also produced that show, which I directed and choreographed, asked if I would get involved as a producer with him to launch Vincent and Flavia in a show called Midnight Tango. And the public took Vincent and Flavia, Midnight Tango, to their hearts. And Karen Bruce, our director, had found this extraordinary tango band, Tango Siempre, to play the music for our show. Oh my goodness, talk about foot tapping. There is no way you could not live to the beat of the tango orchestra.
Tango Siempre, Flores del Alma. I can see that the foot was more than tapping there, Arlene Phillips. I imagine from everything that you've said and all the qualities that you aspire to, that somebody like Carlos Acosta must be like a kind of god to you.
Oh, my goodness. Carlos Acosta is a genius because he can express through his body, even through his beautiful feet, anything and everything in dance. But the language of dance through his body is so expressive. And again, because he has the ability, I mean, he can do everything Cuban, Brazilian. He has so many languages at his, I was going to say his fingertips, but I'll say at his toes, as well as being possibly one of the most superb classical dancers of our day.
Well, I mentioned him because, you know, we began with Bernstein and that slight edge that you get from somebody that has that raw power. Mm-hmm. And that made me think of Carlos too.
Yes.
And to a certain extent, the girl he often dances with at the Royal Ballet, who we also had on this programme quite recently, in his frequent partner, Tamara Rojo.
They're so feisty. They are so in control of not only their bodies, but of their emotions. And the one thing that strikes you about Carlos and Tamara is their passion and the force between them. You can't help being carried away with the excitement that they deliver.
Well, Arlene Phillips, thank you very much for explaining how all of this music fitted into and, in fact, developed your career over the years.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Arlene Phillips was talking to Michael Barclay. And next week on Private Passions, Michael's guest during Radio 3's piano season will be Sir Tim Smit, founder of the Eden Project and a keen pianist himself. Private Passions is a classic arts production for Radio 3. The producer of today's programme was Sarah Cropper.
It was a time when legend gave way to history. Half a millennium between the end of Roman rule and the Norman conquest in 1066. The Anglo-Saxons, rediscovered on BBC Radio 3 through a new series of 30 portraits of groundbreaking Anglo-Saxon men and women.
I stood looking at the gold from the Mercian heartland, evoking that glittering half-pagan, half-Christian world of warlords, warriors and bards.
With speakers including Michael Wood, Seamus Heaney and the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams.
It began this process of turning a ragbag of settlers and pirates into a coalition that saw itself as one people whose destiny was in the hands of God.
The Essay.
Now that was a good king.
Weeknights on BBC Radio 3 at 10:45.
We're back to this Sunday lunchtime in a couple of minutes, today's early music show. But now with the time just gone 1 o'clock, the news read by Ian Skelly.
Five Royal Marines have been charged with the murder of an insurgent in Afghanistan last year. They were arrested last week after police found suspicious video footage on the laptop of a man they were investigating on an unrelated matter. Four other Marines have been released without charge. The Ministry of Defence is reviewing the access to ministers and officials that former army officers are given following newspaper allegations about a number of retired generals. The Sunday Times says they boasted of being able to use their influence to help private firms win lucrative contracts. The men involved have denied wrongdoing, but the Defence Secretary, Philip Hammond, has called the revelations deeply damaging. Mr. Hammond has also said he wants the Territorial Army to change its name and become an integral part of the regular army. He said the Army Reserve would have regular army uniforms and equipment, and that each battalion would be twinned with a regular battalion. The Justice Secretary, Chris Grayling, says the BBC has lessons to learn from the scandal surrounding Jimmy Savile. The police are investigating around 60 allegations of abuse spanning more than four decades. Mr. Grayling added that the corporation had acted correctly in announcing two separate investigations into what happened. The campaign group Human Rights Watch has accused Syria of a significant increase in its use of cluster bombs against civilians. It says it's monitored online videos purporting to show up to 20 cluster bomb strikes across Syria in the past week, compared with three over the previous 18 months. Britain's most prestigious architecture award, the Stirling Prize, has been given to a plant research centre in Cambridge. The Sainsbury Laboratory beat buildings like the Olympic Stadium in London and the Hepworth Art Gallery in Wakefield to the £20,000 prize. And the weather, most places will remain dry and cool with sunny spells throughout the rest of the day. There'll be scattered showers near coastal areas, which will spread across southwestern parts later. And that's the BBC News and the weather. It's 2:30 past one.
And it was read by Ian Skelly. Well, time now on Radio 3 for today's early music show as part of the Piano on the BBC season. Lucy Skeeping presents the second of two programmes about the period piano.
Welcome to the Early Music Show and our second programme this weekend that's part of the piano season here on the BBC. If you were listening yesterday at this time, you'll have heard about the very beginnings of the piano, its invention, if you like, at the Medici court in Italy around 1700, and how it differed from the old harpsichord in that instead of little quills plucking the strings, the notes were produced by hammers hitting the strings. And as the piano began to gain in interest and popularity, I left you with a bit of a cliffhanger about the two main schools of piano making in the 18th century, the Viennese school and the English. Which was better and which eventually won the battle to become the basis of the modern piano? Well, more of that later. But first, we're going to look in more detail at the difference between the two schools. Here's Stephen Devine, Professor of Fortepiano at Trinity College of Music.
The Viennese piano is a very light-cased instrument. Effectively, you have an instrument in an outer case so that the sides of the instrument don't really contribute to the sound production. An English instrument is a solid box, and the outer case is quite thick. It owes a lot more to sort of contemporary harpsichord design. This basically means that the English piano is more resonant, if you like, because more of the wood of the actual instrument is created within the sound. And composers exploited this, and they demand these large pedal open effects, this great sonority. And it's just an exploitation of the English piano sound, this very light damping, this very washy sound, for want of a better word. The Viennese piano, right throughout this period, has very exacting dampers that fit between the strings, so you have absolute clarity. You can create amazing sort of clear effects. I always think of them as crystalline sort of textures in late Mozart, early Beethoven. And that in itself is one of the things that need to be taken on board when you approach an early instrument. Actually, the composer probably wanted that.
So it's the difference in the construction of these instruments, not just in the way the strings work, but in the actual wooden casings as well. Let's hear an example of a Viennese piano first. This is the first movement of Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 15 in B-flat, and it's performed here on Mozart's own piano, made by Anton Walter in around 1780.